Hi, everybody. This is the All Things That Go Bump in the Night podcast. I'm Kelly. I hope you all are staying safe and, you know, things are starting to slowly open up, you know, very slowly starting to go back to our normal that we are used to. I know Washington State is starting with phase two of opening everything up, and I have my fingers crossed that everything is going to be okay. Hope you all are staying safe, and I guess without much further ado, let's get started. Okay, so this week I am doing, I originally had it written as Haunted Places Near Mount St. Helens, but, hi Ginger, I thought I was going to be able to find a lot more haunted places around Mount St. Helens than I did. That, I literally searched all night last night, and I couldn't find a single thing about haunted places. I found one ghost story that I will be covering, but it was just kind of like a little tiny blurb and nothing else. So I changed it up to paranormal things, which paranormal is kind of an umbrella term for unexplained things like UFOs, Sasquatch, other cryptids, stuff like that. So that's what I'm just going to be doing. But to start off, I'm going to get into the timeline of events leading up to the eruption. Because right now, Tuesday is going to be, I believe, the 40-year anniversary of Mount St. Helens erupting. So I kind of wanted to do something, you know, to do with that. So 95 miles south of Seattle, Washington, and 55 miles northeast of Portland lays Mount St. Helens. It was first recognized as a volcano and not just a mountain in 1835. I don't know how they figured that out, but that's just what I had read. On March 16th, 1980, a series of 100 small earthquakes occurred in the area surrounding the volcano. The frequency of these earthquakes continued with about 20 of them in 1 hour on March 24th. On March 27th, the volcano had a small eruption. The steam explosions created a 250-foot wide crater. These steam explosions continued every day, with about 93 of them occurring on March 30th. On April 1st, the explosions shot steam and ash 20,000 feet into the air. And on April 3rd, the crater grew from 250 feet to 1,300 feet. On April 8th, the explosions lasted for 4 hours straight versus before that when they were occurring about, they were only about minutes long when they would release. From the beginning of March, though, these explosions were occurring. Oh no, your video is buffering. Do you guys just want me to update this real quick and then I can restart it? Because I know I don't have too much research to last the full hour, so if it's easier for you guys, I can just restart the computer and install those updates. Is not buffering for you, Eric? Okay. Oh, this is... Can you see me, Eric? Is the video itself buffering with... Okay. All right. Video's good. Not me either, and sound good. I can see you. Okay, yeah, I think it might just be your connection, Ginger. So, from the beginning of March, the explosions were occurring about once per hour every day. But on April 27th, they just all of a sudden just stopped. But that season activity was not long-lasting, because between May 7th and May 17th, small eruptions started happening, as well as over 10,000 earthquakes. For those that are not in Washington, or on this side of the country, Washington, part of Canada, Oregon, and California are all part of the Pacific Ring of Fire, so it is the most... It is the part of the world that has the most active volcanoes in it. A lot of earthquakes, a lot of volcanoes. I know between Portland and Oregon, you can see which is about an hour drive, you can see Mount St. Helens, Mount Hood, and Mount Rainier. And then in parts of Oregon, you can even see what is dubbed as the Three Sisters, which are three other volcanoes. I know those can be seen over on the Oregon coast. So very, very active volcanoes in our side of the country. Let's see here. So the north flank of the volcano began to grow and bulge by 6.5 feet per day, which is a very big, significant amount. And where this bulge was actually on the side of the mountain versus on top. So when it exploded, everything shot from the side and not up like you would imagine a typical volcano. On May 18th at 1980 at 8:32 a.m., a 5.1 magnitude earthquake hit, causing the bulge and summit to slide away, creating the largest debris landslide ever recorded. It flowed north and then west down the valley of the North Fork Toutle River. When the explosion started, the ash flew past the avalanche at 300 miles per hour. For 6 miles, there were no trees left from those explosions. Pyroclastic flows, which are, there's different types of eruptions. So a pyroclastic flow is a dense destructive mass of hot ash, lava fragments, and gases. So those poured out of the now empty bulge at between 50 and 80 miles per hour and covered 5 miles of what is now called the Pumice Plain. Many homes were destroyed and 57 people lost their lives, with ash covering, most of the ash covered Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. But parts, from what I read, a very significant amount covered 11 states, but the ash from this eruption actually went into the atmosphere and it covered basically the entire world had ash from this eruption. My mom was 8 years old at the time when that happened, and she remembered that she was in Lewiston, Idaho, and she thought it was snowing. She went outside and tried, she ate it. Didn't taste very good, but the ash covered everywhere. My son's teacher actually, he was telling me yesterday that she has a jar of the ash that she keeps in her classroom for lessons. But yeah, 57 people lost their lives, which when you think about it, that's not very, very much. These are the three people that are the only ones that are mentioned by name. Adrian, I think my mom was in third grade and my mom has said the same thing about the ash. Yeah, no, your mom's older than my mom. So I think she had to have been in, how old is third grade? I can't remember. I don't know. Maybe she was in third grade. But yeah, lots and lots of ash. I've seen photos and videos. I've watched some documentaries since then, and I was watching, and people would have to stop their cars to sweep off the ash from their cars, and it actually ruined their cars because it was going in through the air intakes. Many cars were destroyed because of it, and those are the ones just from the eastern side of the state and further. But the ash in the red zone, as they called it, was devastating. No life grew there for a very long time. Even now, if you go over to that side of the state, you can see very small trees growing and some vegetation, but there's lots of still just open space near the volcano. But so those killed, like I was mentioning, there's three that are mentioned the most. I don't know the names of any of the other people, unfortunately. Otherwise, I would be mentioning their names. Ginger, my husband's dad worked at Kaiser Aluminum, and they made them change their oil while at work for the drive home because it wouldn't close down. That's ridiculous. You would think for something like that that they would close it down. Like, that's dangerous. LOL, you know, and a paramedic. Oh, your husband's dad was a paramedic? Oh, pandemic. Huh. My bad. Yeah, they're still operating right now, too. Are they considered an essential business? Oh, they're still closed. Okay. Anyways, back to what I was saying. So, Harry Randall Truman was 83 years old and owned a lodge on Spirit Lake. This man is what I envision myself being as an old lady. Like, he is your stereotypical get off my lawn old man. Very crotchety, very grumpy. He refused to evacuate his lodge because he'd been there for many, many years. He had 14 cats, Eric. He had 14 cats. That is me. That is going to be me. So anyways, where his lodge was actually right at the bottom of the mountain. So, or the volcano. So his lodge was hit by the debris landslide and his body unfortunately was never found. So what had happened was, you know, the landslide hit, but then all of the ash that came down actually blocked and created a dam in the lake. So it caused everything to back up. And if you actually go over there now, you can see this brand new, really deep lake because it just backed up so much. But yeah, his body was unfortunately never found. You can actually find interviews of him where he talks about how he's not leaving. He did not believe that the volcano was going to erupt at all. He did a lot of news interviews about it. David didn't want the photographers. Actually, I was going to get there, Ginger. So one of the other people that died was, David A. Johnston, who was a 30-year-old volcanologist. He was near the volcano monitoring it when it erupted. His last transmission to the U.S. Geological Survey was during the eruption saying, "Vancouver, Vancouver, this is it," before the transmission went dead. His body was also never found, but the observatory near the mountain is named the Johnson Ridge Observatory after him. He's credited with saving many lives in the days leading up to the eruption because of how outspoken he was about how dangerous Mount St. Helens was. Johnston also, he helped persuade the authorities to limit access to the volcano, and then he pushed to resist heavy pressure to reopen it, thereby holding the May 18th death toll, to only a few tens versus hundreds or even thousands of people. 27-year-old photojournalist Reed Blackburn had been documenting the events leading up to the eruption for National Geographic, the USGS, and a local paper called The Columbian. On the morning of May 18th, Reed was camping on a site called Coldwater Creek, 8 miles from the north side of the volcano where it erupted. Reed had just enough time to get into his car before he was caught in the superheated cloud of ash, pumice, and gas. His remains were found in his car a few days later. The film in his camera, unfortunately, was so damaged that they were not able to develop it. In 2013, however, a photo editor for The Columbian found an undeveloped roll of film with photos that Reed had taken while on a helicopter flight over the eruption. The National Press Photographers Foundation created an annual $2,000 scholarship in his name. So, let's see here. Go back through my notes. So from spring to fall of 1980, the volcano continued to have small eruptions before finally going back to sleep. These eruptions created a new lava dome that became 10,000 feet above the crater's floor. In 2004, though, she awoke again. I actually do remember when that happened. I was in middle school. I believe I was in eighth grade. And my mom was terrified. She bought us face masks. We were the only kids in our school that went to school with face masks on because she was so scared that it was going to hit again. Because I'm an asthmatic and I can't be around ash anyways. But she was so scared about it. We used to sit and watch the news religiously. Our school even put TVs in our cafeteria so that way they could watch, we could watch the news while we were in on lunch. The volcano produced about one dump truck of lava into the crater per second for 3.5 years. I remember the reporters calling it burping to relieve the pressure that was building, which would help with going long periods of time between big eruptions. So one of the first reports of paranormal activity that I have is a vanishing hitchhiker. After the May 1980 eruption, many people claimed to seeing a woman dressed in all white on the side of the road with her thumb out in the area. They would pull over to pick her up, and after sitting in silence for a while, she would say, "The volcano is going to erupt again between October 12th and October 14th, before disappearing." Now, I don't know exactly how far back that legend goes, but the 2004 little burping eruptions that she did occur on October 12th. So that was pretty interesting, I thought at least. It had to have gone back a long time though, because Unsolved Mysteries actually had an episode on her. But when I think of that story, I think of the Lady in White, which is it's an urban legend revolving usually. This is weird for me that, like, this whole thing is about a volcano and not a traditional woman in white story, because typically a woman in white is a woman whose husband cheats on her, and in a fit of psychosis, she drowns her children and then kills herself. And as a spirit, she comes back looking for her children, you know, and a lot of times it's hitchhiking. La Llorona is actually one of the biggest stories of a woman in white. And so that's why it's really weird to me that this woman in white would be talking about an eruption. But I don't know. I did see a few posts where people were saying that they knew a person who had picked her up. I think that's just, you know, one of the typical urban legends. You know, you never really find out who the source of these stories are. You always just know a person of a person of a person of a person who did this. Bettina Marie wrote an article for the website Your Ghost Stories, which was published on March 19th, 2018, about a hike that she took with her boyfriend. And they heard a weird noise on the hiking trails on Mount St. Helens. It was getting dark, so they decided to head home, but decided to pull into an empty parking lot to stargaze. After laying on the pavement for about 2 minutes, they heard a loud plastic-type popping, like what you would hear when removing the lid off of, like, a Tupperware container. The sound came from the woods directly across the road from them. They immediately got in their car and left, not seeing anything. She did claim that the area that they were in was part of the blast zone. So the only trees that were there were very small trunks. They had only been recently planted probably within the last 30 years. So really small. You should be able to see behind them if there's a person or an animal back there. There were also a lot of bushes. So if an animal was back there, you would have been able to hear it rummaging around, especially because her and her boyfriend live in the woods. So they typically know what animals sound like, but they didn't hear that at all. To me, that doesn't sound anything like paranormal. Even as I was reading it, I was like, that doesn't really sound paranormal. That sounds like it could be an atmospheric thing, like thunder. You know, thunder isn't actual thunder. I mean, it's not anything physical or anything like that. It's just pressure building in the air. But one person did comment, which I was really happy to see. I had to scroll through a ton of different comments. But one of the comments was about his theory that she heard a frost crack, which I did not know anything about that. And as I read about it, it made a lot more sense. He wrote that when water freezes, it expands in volume. The sap in trees are made of water diluted with carbohydrates and minerals, which act as antifreeze. Depending on how much sap is in the tree, its sugar content, and the temperature, it can result in a vertical cracking in the trunk, creating a loud popping sound. These frost cracks can also occur when the temperature is warming up. And seeing as, you know, they were going, Bettina was hiking in mid-June, that really makes me think, like, that's what that could possibly be. I think that's probably the most logical explanation for the sound that she heard. On November 17th, 2005, a hiker on Silver Star Mountain, which is just 45.3 miles south of Mount St. Helens, caught pictures of what is believed to be Bigfoot. There was tons of snow, and those who have studied the photos and believe it, that it is not a person. There were no lines of clothing. The hump on the back of its neck could be a large chunk of fur. They said that snowshoers and backpackers look vastly different. Bigfoot investigator John Callender interviewed the photographer, and he believed that the man was credible and that these photos are not a hoax. Now, I don't know how credible that is, but Gifford National Park, which is where, you know, Silver Star Mountain is known to be a hotbed for Bigfoot sightings. I do have those photos that I want to show to you guys now. Oh, wait a minute. There we go. I'm going to show you guys those now. Okay, so it's these two photos. So there's this one. You can see something right there. And then here's a close-up photo of it. So I don't know. I think to me that looks like a shoulder and maybe somebody having some kind of hood over their face to keep it warm on the mountains, but but I thought that was pretty interesting myself. Adrian, my Uncle John has a story about hearing Bigfoot while camping once with my grandpa. Where was your dad camping at, Adrian? Was it over in Washington? Because I know your dad lives over in like the Midwest-ish areas now. Are you there, Adrian? Yes, he was in Washington. I think it was early 1980 to 1985. Tell your dad to get a hold of me. I would love to pick his brain. Like, I would absolutely love to pick his brain. Tell your dad to get a hold of me. So, in April 2007, 84-year-old Coeur d'Alene resident Joy French... So this made me really excited. Somebody from Coeur d'Alene, very small. It's literally like a 45-minute drive from me. Her name was Joy French. She began hosting UFO meetings, claiming that she was abducted by aliens in the early 1980s from a small trailer on Lake Merwin, which is 39 miles southwest of Mount St. Helens. She said that her friend Don McCann was camping in the area and called her on the CB radio asking her to drive down to his trailer so that way they could watch a movie together. Okay, so she hops in her car, drives down there, but next thing she knows, she's no longer in her car. I mean, she's back in her car, but she's not driving anymore. Her friend Don was. She has no memory of how ever getting to Don's house or getting in his car or letting him drive her car. She said, that was really unusual to me. I'm drinking wine. She's like, I'm very independent. I don't like people driving me around. I usually do all of the driving, and I wasn't drinking or anything like that. But it was between 10 and 11 p.m., so it was completely dark out. Suddenly, the sky turned bright as if it was daylight. And all of a sudden, the car stopped. So they were in Joy's 1966 Cadillac. Don, being a mechanic, hopped out to see what was wrong with the engine. And he was like, nothing's wrong. That's the last thing they remember. Next thing she knows, she's waking up at home in her own trailer. And so she called him up back on the CB and she was like, meet me in the community kitchen, because they were at like a campground that had trailers, so they could talk about what happened. So when she met him, she said that that's what happens when UFOs are around. Don responded saying that he thought that's what happened, but they never spoke of it again. She believes that the light came from a spaceship where they were taken to be examined before having their memories wiped and returned to their cars. She swears that in 2006, she had a friend in Idaho, a childhood friend, that she had confided in this story in. The friend told her about a UFO that she had seen while picking huckleberries, but the government told her not to speak about it. Joy feels that while being examined, the aliens saw that she had had a complete hysterectomy, rendering her useless to them, so they returned her back to Earth. She is adamant that the government knows about them and are just trying to cover them up, but the aliens don't want to harm us. Instead, they're trying to save our world. I don't think they want to hurt us. I think they want to save us from destroying the planet or pick us up after we destroy it. Again, I don't really know what to believe with that story. I'm a believer in aliens, like plain truth. I believe in aliens. Like, that's not the issue here, but I think that, you know, this was during a time where date rape drugs were more popular. You know, you could get Quaaludes super easily. Didn't the government just release UFO classified information? Yes, they did, actually. I believe it was Project Blue Book, where they were releasing all of that alien documentation, all of the alien sightings and stuff like that. E.T. wanted to go home, and yes, they did. but again, Quaaludes were so super popular in this time. I mean, it's not a stretch to think that this guy might have gotten Quaaludes and slipped it to her. You don't have to have... You don't need alcohol to date rape somebody. I'm not giving like a how-to on how to date rape anybody or anything like that. Like, that's absolutely terrible, but... I just don't think that's what happened. And the fact that they never talked about it ever again, like, I'm sorry, if I thought I was getting picked up by aliens and my friend was with me, nah, we're talking about that all the time. We're going over every detail. We're going to try to figure out what's going on. We're going to go through hypnosis. We're going to go through memory regression, like, or repression, going through our repressed memories. Like, we're trying to figure that crap out. Like, I don't know. I think the minute she said, I think this is aliens, the guy was like, that's it. Yes, we got abducted by aliens. Yeah, that's totally what happened. You know, but I do want to meet this woman. I do want to sit down and I want to pick her brain and see what, you know, what all else she could tell me. Because she's been doing these UFO conventions she started in 2006. So... 14 years now. It'd be interesting to see what all she knows. I'm going to have to see if I can find her on Facebook or something. Where'd I go? So on October 20th, 2004, the Mount St. Helens webcam picked up a UFO just above the new lava dome. In its crater, just before the steam plume suddenly stopped. UFO believers think that this UFO entered the crater or even the mountain to stop the steam eruptions. So I have another photo of that webcam photo. So I'm going to show that to you again. Or show that to you guys now. Let's see here. Wrong one. This one. So it's kind of small to see. Oh, wrong one. Zoom in. There we go. So they think this thing right here, this red thing, is a UFO. I don't think that's what that is. I think it could be a lot of things. You know, it could be a bug in front of the lens. It could be a lot of things. And that camera, I mean, webcams are not good for distance photos. So it could be a bird. It could be really anything. I think it's just a coincidence that it happened to show up right before the eruption started or stopped, but that's just me. On March 1st, 1999, an employee for the Washington State Forestry Service called the National UFO Reporting Center about something they had experienced. At the time, the phone was unmanned, but the employee left a voicemail. In that voicemail, the employee said that a group of forestry workers had seen an elk being lifted into an unknown object. Robert A. Fairfax, director of investigations for the Washington State chapter of the National UFO Reporting Center, went to the location on March 5th to investigate. Altogether, there were 14 witnesses. These witnesses said that on February 25th, just a few minutes before noon, three forestry workers who were planting seedling trees near Mount St. Helens reported seeing a small disc-shaped object slowly drifting over a nearby ridge to their south and descend into the valley to the north of their position. The object descended silently with what the witnesses thought seemed to be a purposeful manner, exhibiting a slight wobble to its flight. The three workers thought that maybe it was a parachute, but quickly realized it wasn't so and called their 11 co-workers who were out there with them to come see. The crew witnessed the disc floating to a herd of elk in the valley, which remained oblivious to the object. That is until the disc got close and then the herd just bolted, except for one lone elk. At this point, the object honed in on it, somehow lifted it into the air, and at this point, the disc began to wobble more, like a lot more. As the elk got close to the disc up in the air, you know, it's levitating up to the disc seemed to slightly increase in size. The disc began to fly back up into the air, but this is where I'm a little bit confused. So it says it took a 360-degree turn left when it began to brush the top of the trees. I think they mean a 180, because a 360, it's just going to end up back the way that it was hitting those trees. But yeah, so it began to do that when it began to brush the tops of the trees at the top of the slope before taking off at a fast speed and disappearing. At that point, the elk had disappeared inside the disc. They did eventually find the carcass of an elk nearby, as well as a pregnant cow, but it's unknown if they were in any way related to this sighting. The elk were not tagged or anything like that. They were wild elk. It could just be a coincidence. I mean, it's the wild. You come across dead animals frequently, especially on a road, you know. So, In March of 1969, just south of the Ape Caves and Mount St. Helens, hikers found a very large footprint in the snow believed to be from Bigfoot. I forgot to save those photos, but I can grab them real quick. They're really fascinating to look at. This footprint was 27 inches long, with the ball of the foot measuring 7.5 inches wide and the heel measuring 4.5 inches wide. It also only had 4 toes. The Ape Caves are believed to be the home of Bigfoot because they are very vast. They can easily hold a big animal of that size. And that same month, too, there were numerous reports of Bigfoot sightings in the area of the Ape Cave caves. All of them said that whatever the creature was between 8 and 10 feet tall, walked on 2 feet, and was covered head to toe in a dark-colored fuzzy fur. and had the face of an ape. For many years, he was known as the Ape Man before we knew him as Sasquatch or Bigfoot. I do think bears, especially grizzly bears, are known to walk on 2 feet. I want to believe in the Bigfoot. I really do. I really absolutely do. But it's hard to when there are bears that walk on 2 feet. They're covered in big brown fur. And they, you know, they kind of have the snout. Or, I mean, if their snout was like flush with their face, it would be identical. But I just don't know. So I'm going to go look for that link or that photo real quick. Bigfoot near Mount St. Helens. I'm just bringing up my previous search histories. Let's see here. Where did it go? Was it? Nope, that's... Oh, yes, this is it. Okay. So I'm going to save this image. And these are photos taken from the newspaper. So it's not like, you know, they're hoaxes that people from the internet are making. These are actual newspaper clippings. Let's see here. Close out of that. Go back to, there we go. Okay, so I'm going to share again to show that to you. Okay, so these are the Bigfoot photos. So that you got the four toes right here, the heel, and this whole thing measured 27 and a half inches long. Like, that's huge. I don't know a single animal that has a foot that big. And then this is the newspaper clipping where I got the reports of what it looked like. And then I had another photo that I wanted to show you guys as well. This was one of the most iconic photos ever taken of Mount St. Helens. They don't know who the author or who the photographer is. They have an idea, but anybody who tries to find the guy, all of his phone numbers are gone. His Facebook is deleted now. It's been missing for many years, and we just don't know if this guy is still alive. But he did drive a red Pinto, and he was supposed to be going out to ride his motorcycle that day. But I mean, this is just devastating how big that ash cloud is. And that's just the initial blast. I know that it bent the wheels of the car. I don't think he did die, though, because the guy that they think it was did have a Facebook account. And if he died in the eruption, he would not have been able to create one. And he had phone numbers that was registered in his name, cell phone numbers. And just everything is just not turning up at all. So it could be a missing persons thing. It could be a death. We just don't know what happened to him. But I do know that I came across a few websites where people were asking, hey, has anybody seen this person? I didn't think to write the name down. I should have, but I wasn't thinking. I was just trying to get all my notes done. But yeah, that's all I got. There was a lot. I didn't want to do just a ton of UFO and Sasquatch stories, unfortunately. That's where most of my time went with this research, was I was trying so hard to find ghosts, because with 57 deaths, you would think that there would, in traumatic deaths, 57 traumatic deaths, you would think that there would be something, but I didn't find anything besides the lady in white, unfortunately. And that is going to be that for this week, guys. Sorry I didn't get more in-depth into the paranormal side of it. I was shocked by how little ghost stories I could find surrounding Mount St. Helens. But seeing as that side of the state is rife with UFOs and Sasquatch sightings, I'm glad I was able to find quite a few surrounding that. But yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed it. Again, the 40-year anniversary, I believe it's 40 years, will be on May 18th, so that's going to be Tuesday. Just kind of think about those that were lost. You know, think about the people who lost their lives from those explosions, and be thankful that we are able to predict with more certainty when eruptions are going to happen, you know, and be able to plan ahead for those things, you know, being able to know that we have the systems in place to alert those who are in danger. And I'm very thankful for that. I hope you all are good. As I said at the beginning, I hope you guys are practicing good social distancing protocols. You know, I know a lot of people are against wearing masks, but because they won't protect you from the virus, they're not meant to protect you from the virus. They're meant to stop you from touching your face and from sneezing on everything. So I highly recommend, if you're going into a crowded place for essential shopping, please continue to wear those masks. I know myself are immune compromised. My family, I have multiple immune compromised members of my family, and I'm a caregiver to immune compromised people. I would be devastated if I picked it up and gave it to one of my kids or my clients. You know, we got to think about other people in these times of needs. But yeah, have a wonderful week, guys.